Welcome to 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. I'm Michael Colville Anderson. Welcome to My Happy Place, my podcast where I self-medicate against my constant overthinking and anxiety about my own mortality with tiny happy pills of positivity and reflection. Number 70. Eavesdropping. I like to listen in on what other people are saying. I mentioned it in the chapter about conversation, and eavesdropping is both related and unrelated. There are many reasons why I gravitate to cities and can't imagine living anywhere else, but the opportunity for eavesdropping is, of course, far more developed. Cities are a constant flow of dialogue and storytelling. There are Instagram accounts that capitalize on both the inherent eavesdropping in cities as well as our desire to take part in it. Overheard in LA. Overheard in New York. These are two that I love to follow. People submit funny things they've overheard on the street or in a bar. They're popular, and that explains a lot about the human desire to listen in. I interviewed the legendary French screenwriter Jean-Claude Carrière many years ago. And he said that he always carried a notebook around his entire life in order to write down snippets of conversation, great lines, and authentic interactions, all for possible later use in his work writing screenplays. In a way, this is eavesdropping with the potential to make art and or money doing it. But imagine being paid to essentially eavesdrop, and you're not even a spy. Since film school, I have been constantly in awe of the ability of sound people in film and TV to listen intently. It's their job to record conversation and other sounds, and all the sound guys I know excel at it. When filming my TV series, The Life-Size City, we have two different sound guys depending on the episode. When there is a break in filming, I often see them turn their boom and mic in other directions, recording extra sounds that we need for the series, of course, but also listening in on conversations out of interest. One of these guys is particularly astute at listening. He can tell the difference between the sound of wings on European and North American bees. We've worked together many times, and he once said to me, after we resumed filming after lunch, "Oh, this is your afternoon voice. I like your afternoon voice." I'm like, "What?" I asked for details, and it was a bit hard to explain how my voice is different in the evening, compared to the afternoon, compared to the morning. But anyway, I like this level of detail in eavesdropping. I don't know why, but I have developed the weird ability to follow conversations on the other side of the room even while I'm sitting right there talking to you. Even several conversations all around me at a bar or restaurant. It is always activated, it seems. I can't really turn it off. But sometimes I guess I can turn down the volume, especially if I'm having a good conversation. Then I zoom in on that. If the conversation is less interesting or I'm alone, I can't unhear all the words around me. Generally, I like it, but sometimes I wish I could avoid it. In an earlier chapter about languages, this is closely related. I find it refreshing to travel to a country where I don't understand a word of the language, which makes it impossible to eavesdrop. It is liberating for me to be able to take a break from listening in on other people's conversations. I think it's pretty universal. We love gossip, and eavesdropping will always elicit opinions and judgments. Oh my God, listen to that guy. Boy, is he ever stupid. Oh my, I totally agree with her on that topic. Or, what a beautiful or horrible voice. Or, I just can't believe that man over there just said that. In my other podcast, the Life-Size City Urbanism Podcast, there is an episode about the erotic city, where I have a conversation with a good friend and urbanist about the erotic elements of living in cities, including all the things we experience with eavesdropping. I think the city where I have overheard strangers having sex the most is Barcelona. It's densely populated, and in the summers all the windows are open. The soundtrack of people having sex is ever present. In the chapter about hotel rooms, this is also part of the game. Some people don't like it, but I know that many people do. It can be erotic and sexy or just funny. Copenhagen, too, in the summer, also features many sexual sounds, what with all the open windows. Okay, I just remembered.
talking about memories, I just remembered a New Year's Day in the mid-90s. I was living with a girlfriend in an old Copenhagen apartment. Suddenly, through the wall came the sound of passionate lovemaking. We had never heard any sounds from that apartment before. It was funny at first, but then we were confused. Wait, we heard different voices. So we both took a glass and started listening through the wall, finally determining that there were four people in the next apartment, all engaged in sexy activities together. I've noticed when booking hotels on a website like Booking.com that many newer hotels list soundproof rooms as a feature, along with TV, minibar, and all that. While many of us like listening in on other people's lovemaking, many more might like to stay in a room that both limits the sounds from other rooms, but also helps muffle the sounds that we might be making in our own. Although I might not want to travel to Oklahoma. According to their state law, every person guilty of secretly loitering about any building with intent to overhear discourse therein and to repeat or publish the same to vex, annoy, or injure others is guilty of a misdemeanor. This is one of the very few examples I can find of legislation limiting eavesdropping, even though it is nobly meant to limit vexing, annoying, and injuring others. But yeah, at the end of the day, tell me your stories without knowing that you're doing it. Number 71, people watching. I rarely spend time in the country. I mean, I like the country. I like communing with nature on occasion. I know the science about why it is beneficial and important for humans to spend more time there. But I need people around me, lots of them. I need to watch them, study them, learn about them and from them, be fascinated by them. Another reason I'm a city boy. It is a lifelong fascination. I remember focusing on it back in my early teens, not knowing why I did it back then, just doing it and just needing to do it. It is still a constant. While walking down a street or finding great vantage points at cafes in my own city or while traveling. In a new city, it's like getting a read on the place by watching the locals. I have a thing about sunglasses. Now I have more than 20 pairs and I am constantly on the lookout for new designs. I never wear jewelry and have never really worn a watch, so sunglasses are my primary accessory. But I started wearing them subconsciously when I was a young man and only realized why years later. It is much easier to people watch when they can't see your eyes. You can study people in great detail in public without them knowing it. When I get a new pair of sunglasses, I invariably ask one of my kids, hey, have a look here. Can you see my eyes? Just to double check that they're dark enough. I've mastered the technique. I know that turning my head to follow someone is a giveaway, sunglasses or not. So I keep my head still and follow with my eyes behind the shades. I usually have a book with me at cafes, and it can add an extra layer to ensuring that I can watch without being noticed. Holding the book up like I'm reading it, but I'm deeply involved in observing that person or those people over there. I feel like I'd make a great old-school spy. Vantage points are very important. My local wine bar, where I have been hanging out for, oh my god, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, is located on one of the favorite streets of Copenhageners. A narrow street between two larger ones that connects neighborhoods. The cafe has outdoor seating on the sidewalk and faces another cafe on the opposite side of the street. There is so much life to be observed. People walking or cycling past. The other people on the other side of the street. Your head swivels back and forth like you're watching a tennis match. One of my friends, who gets me, he suggested that we try a new cocktail bar in another neighborhood. He said that they have outdoor seating, but then he said, probably in order to get me away from my other wine bar, hey, dude, you are going to love it. It is a different street typology, and it's on a corner, so there will be a totally different angle for you to study people. He was right. At my regular wine bar, people flow past in the middle of the block, left to right. At this cocktail bar, bikes sweep around corners. There's a square on the other side where people hang out. Ooh, a whole new world from this vantage point. Sometimes I sit inside at the bar at my local place. One side of the bar faces inwards, so your back is to the window and the street. I usually sit along the sides, but once I was stuck looking in the wrong direction. I was talking to a friend for a very long time, and suddenly I wondered why on earth my neck was hurting. I realized I was constantly glancing over my shoulder to see the street and street life. I didn't realize it until then that I simply need to watch, even when hanging out with a friend and having a conversation. It can be a lonely affliction. At its core, observation is a private undertaking. You watch, notice, think. A running play-by-play commentary with someone else kind of defeats the purpose. I've met so few people in my life that engage in it as much as I do. I have a few friends who have learned it, and when we're sitting at a cafe, they can get game face on for keeping their eyes peeled. The force is strong within my daughter. When she was younger, we would go to cafes and hang out and talk, as well as looking out the window at street life, or at the people in the cafe. She has a strange ability to notice everything. If I move a plant to another windowsill, she walks in and in 2 seconds, she notices. It's really wild. She's the only human in my life who can match me in noticing stuff. We can walk down a crowded pedestrian street on a busy Saturday, and all I need to say is, "Huh, wild shoes, huh?" And she'll say, "Oh, yep, they were." Because I know that she saw them too. The exact shoes that I'm talking about in that ocean of people. With other people, they're like, "Oh, what? Sorry, which shoes?" Or I comment on the shoes as they're approaching so the person I'm with has time to notice them. It is strangely soothing to hang out with my kid knowing that we are observational equals. I've been working from home for a couple of years, and my desk is at the window. Of course it is, overlooking the street. I live on a busy intersection in a densely populated neighborhood. Throughout the day, my head turns to look out the window at the people passing by. All day long. This passion to people watch started when I was young, but now, as an urbanist, oh, it fits perfectly into my work doing what's called direct human observation. Back in 2012, I stuck a camera out the window and filmed an intersection for 12 hours and hired an anthropologist to study the behavior of the 16,631 citizens on bikes who rolled past. I had discovered that in 130 years of the bicycle, there had hardly been any behavioral studies of people on bikes, anywhere. So I became that guy, and continued for years. I have stared closely at over 100,000 cyclists in 5 cities, analyzing their behavior in great detail. How they use the bike, their body language, their facial expressions, you name it. From these observations, a fascinating world of learning and data emerged. Things nobody had ever noticed were revealed. All in all, a brilliant combination of people watching and urban life and mobility. But once you start seeing things, you can never unsee them. The French writer Georges Perec is a brother from another mother. He is more well known now for other books like La Disparition or A Void from 1969. The book was written entirely without using the letter E, as was its translation. But he wrote a thin volume called An Attempt at Exhausting a Place in Paris. This is such a simple book with a simple premise. Perec just recorded everything he saw while sitting at a cafe on a Parisian square over 3 days. When I lived in Paris in the 1990s, I had a dog-eared French version of this book, and I dutifully went to the same place. Not to record my own observations, but maybe to try and see things that Perec might have seen 20 years prior. A city dweller regards their city. This book is at once nothing, and yet it is everything about urban life. It is generally a solitary activity. But teaming up with a like-minded friend takes it to the next level. Apart from my eagle-eyed daughter, I have a couple of female friends with whom I developed a kind of game. We go to a restaurant, bar, or cafe to spend time together. But after we're settled, we'll scan the room, guessing about all the people around us. That couple over there, oh my God, they've been together way too long, and they should probably end it. And those two, oh my God, that is such a first date. Oh my God, look at her, she's bored. Look at her closed body language. Oh, and look at him, he's so desperately trying to be funny and engaging. And so on. Then, after a while, we'll scan again to see if anything has changed. Oh, whoa, whoa, look at her. Look, her body language is open now, and she's smiling. They're getting along much better. Sometimes, however, we are completely stumped. We have no idea about the relationship between those two people or that table of five over there. Then we challenge each other to find out. We have to go deeper to find the answer. Employing stealthy techniques is my modus operandi. I like this game. But one of these friends, you know what she does? She just walks right over and says, "Hi, me and my friend over there are playing an anthropology game, and we're wondering who you are and what your relationship is. Thanks." And she gets the answer right away. My way is more fun. Come on. But either way, it's always interesting. Since I made this list of 100 things I'll miss when I'm dead, I've shuffled them around a bit, deleted some from the list, and combined others. A segment entitled Micro Expressions, Body Language, and Psychology was meant to be on its own, but now I can see that it's an extension of people watching. In 11th and 12th grade in high school, I took a psychology class. Along with English class, writing skills, and all that, what I learned in this psychology class, I have used in my life more than anything else. It completely captured my imagination. All about body language, facial expressions, you name it. Like when a person looks up and to the left when thinking about what to say, that usually means they're going to lie, or they're unsure. You look up to the right, and a person is channeling the practical part of their brain, so they're probably trying to remember something in order to answer. Crossing arms or crossing legs away from the person you're talking to, that's closed behavior, which often reveals discomfort, disinterest, what have you. We saw those old psychology films from the 60s and 70s in those classes, showing us examples. There was one I remember well. It featured a payphone on a street. Maybe some of you actually remember those. And the researchers, they left a dime in the slot. Whenever you used a payphone back in the day, you invariably checked the slot to see if there was a coin. Once in a while, you were lucky. Everybody did it. Then they filmed men using the phone and checking the slot as they left. A woman would walk up to them and ask, "I just used the phone and I forgot my dime. Did you find it?" They did it in two ways. With one group of men, the woman didn't touch them. In another group, she gently and hardly noticeably touched their arm. When she didn't touch them, 80% of the men lied, saying they didn't find the dime, even though they were filmed taking it. When she touched them slightly, 80% were honest and said, "Yeah, totally, here's your dime." I latched onto that technique and never let go. When I was a young server in restaurants, I would do that imperceptible touch with customers, just on the elbow, just on the shoulder, thinking it might get me a bigger tip. I still use it all the time, almost every single day. I am constantly reading people, especially when I'm interacting with them. Are they bored with the story? Is my flirting successful? Oh my God, no it's not. Or do they find that person over there more attractive? It's all like eavesdropping. It runs separately in the background, in a room in my head, but it's ever present. There is observing, but then there is applying the knowledge in the opposite direction, using body language to send subliminal signals to the person you're talking to. Maybe I'm super tired and I realize it might be obvious, so I switch up my posture, activate muscles in my face in order to try and let the person know, you know, that I'm interested. Or if a person is boring or irritating, using negative body language to hopefully send a signal to shut them up. In 2002, I finally completed months of work on a feature film screenplay fresh out of film school and stood there staring at the slow printer as it churned out the pages. Two holes were punched, a metal bracket affixed, and I went out. I needed to read it from start to finish and in a different location. I went to a cafe that I frequented at the time. I like football, and the World Cup was on, I remember, and Denmark was playing that evening. That was important. But I made an exception. Reading my screenplay, my work, the fruit of my labors, was more important. I ordered a beer and sat down with the screenplay and a pen. It takes a while to read a 120-page screenplay very carefully. I had a couple more beers during the process. Oh, then finally, man, I was done. What a rush. The completion of a long creative journey, and I actually liked what I had written. But for the first time since I arrived at the cafe, I looked up and around. The most amazing sight greeted me. I had been oblivious to my surroundings. What I saw was a thing of beauty, a cafe filled with women, all of them in pairs, and I was the only man in the place. And I was deemed to be very interesting. In that room right then, I was Brad Pitt. Flirtatious eye contact came from every direction. Not a normal situation for me to be in. I subtly grabbed my Nokia mobile phone and texted my friend Jakob, telling them to get down to the cafe immediately. But Denmark's plane, man, I said, I know, still, get down here. To his credit, he did. I got him up to speed on the bizarre situation. He recognized how extraordinary it was. The menfolk were away watching football, and the womenfolk teamed up and went out for some drinks. And we were in an ocean surrounded by the latter. It was a good night. But later, we analyzed it. That evening was probably once in a lifetime, and I remember it in great clarity, but we tried to figure out how to develop a tactic. We talked about psychology, and Jakob had heard about something called mimetic desire, a theory by the French academic René Girard. Man is the creature who does not know what to desire, and he turns to others in order to make up his mind. We desire what others desire because we imitate their desires. Basically, we want something if someone else wants it first. If a woman walks into a bar filled with men and nobody looks at her or finds her attractive, then she's just a customer in a bar. But when one man starts to check her out, then all the others subconsciously do as well. That's what happened in that cafe, just with the roles reversed. Being two single guys back then, we tried to figure out how to bottle it, as it were. We developed a game that we played for a few years. We called it Monk Hour. We're out with our male friends on a weekend night in cafes and bars filled with humans we found attractive. And then one of us, out of the blue, we could declare Monk Hour. Oh, the others would groan and protest, but we knew we had to play. It was simple. We were not allowed to make eye contact with any woman in the place for 1 hour. A timer was set on one of these Nokia telephones. We started talking with each other, which, of course, is a good thing, ignoring everything around us. Back then, you could smoke inside, and before long, there were suddenly a lot of women who didn't have a lighter and who came over to get a light. We could light it for her, sure, but no eye contact and no words apart from, sure, yeah, no problem, yeah, you're welcome. After an hour, the phone alarm would go off, and we were freed. We would look around. And while it wasn't as spectacular as my first time, we were definitely more interesting because we had ignored everyone. Then, it was every man for himself. It was a fun psychology game with an hour of good conversation with friends, followed by, hopefully, a larger margin of success on the single market. That has stuck with me for years. I'm not demonstrative about it, but always playing around with it a little bit, reversing the psychology. Listening to myself, listing all these counter tactics, okay, it actually sounds a little bit dodgy and manipulative. It might be the latter, but you know what? It's all innocent enough. I've read books about cat and dog psychology, learning tips and tricks to interacting with them, how to read how they are doing, but also how to let them know my intentions as a human. Imagine my thrill when I stumbled upon a TV series called Lie to Me, starring Tim Roth. In it, he is the world's leading expert on microexpressions and has a consultancy with a partner. She's an expert on tonality in people's voices. They're hired by people and the FBI to solve crimes using their skills to determine if suspects are lying or telling the truth. Oh, I was riveted. While my daughter is my equal in observation, my son, who was 9 at the time, surprised me by wanting to sit with me and watch the series. It wasn't his normal thing to watch, but he was just as riveted. He made up a game on his own afterwards. He would get his little sister to hide a tennis ball in one of the 8 cupboards in the bathroom without him seeing which one. Then he would ask her, "Is the ball in this one?" And then he would try to read her expressions and body language to find the answer. That series led me down a whole rabbit hole into the world of micro-expressions. A micro-expression is a brief, involuntary facial expression that appears on a person's face according to the emotions being experienced. Unlike regular, prolonged facial expressions, it is difficult to fake one. There are 7 universal microexpressions: disgust, anger, fear, sadness, happiness, surprise, and contempt. They often occur as fast as 1/15th to 1/25th of a second. The face is the primary indicator of a person's emotions. I am certainly no expert, but I have trained myself to notice them. That little twitch at the corner of the mouth or the eye, the lips pursing almost imperceptibly. I amuse myself with all manner of games, like trying to change the mood and direction of a conversation or an atmosphere in a social situation. If, on occasion, I am faced with someone who is angry and wants to argue or even fight, I respond to them by simply laughing, even if I'm furious as well. Man, a laugh throws them completely off guard and changes the dynamic. In writing for films and acting, there is the important dramaturgical element of status. Which characters have the higher or lower status in an interaction? The main character always needs to be under pressure and have their status challenged. That is what makes drama. Laughing unexpectedly is a way of tipping the status game in your favor, as well as hopefully defusing a situation. A simple game I do is walking down a street with sunglasses on and then smiling. People smiling to themselves, man, without reading a book or looking at their phone, it really is a little bit unusual. So I love to watch how people coming towards me react when they see my smile. It's a game with no real point to it at all. It's just fun observation. Then there are the differences you see in different countries and cultures. The differences in universal human body language in a reserved culture like the Nordic or the Japanese compared to the more gregarious cultures in Latin countries. For all my lifelong fascination with people watching, there are strange limits once in a while. I was in Kashgar, the hub of the ancient Silk Road, located in the desert of southwestern China back in 1992. I was walking around, exploring the city, and I came to an intersection and looked down a narrow neighborhood street. I was about to head down, but suddenly something stopped me. I can't explain it, really, but something just said, "Yeah, dude, no, don't go down that street." Sometimes you just have to turn it off, for whatever reason. It's all like having a secret language. You don't know I speak it, but I am harvesting much more information and impressions than normal. Okay, right, now you do know that I do it if you're listening to this podcast, but hey, it's still all just humans observing humans. It's what we do and what we like to do as a species. Being dead, man, it's gonna suck. Nobody to watch. You've been listening to 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. I'm Michael Koble Anderson. Thanks for being out there.